This episode is brought to you by IVP. Use promo code IVP examine 40. That's IVPEXAMEN 40 at ivpress.com to get 40% off and free US shipping on any IVP resources mentioned in this episode.
Is hard. But what if surrender is the key to experiencing joy and freedom? In her book, The Freedom of Surrender, author Mary DeMuth invites you on a 40-day journey where you'll learn how to give God your inner struggles, your family, your expectations, your regrets, your ministry, your grief, and much more. Experience freedom as you invite Jesus to help you surrender all. And as a listener of this podcast, you can receive a special discount on this book. Check the show notes for more details.
This is IVP.
The gospel is for the moments when things seem to be falling apart. And this is when we can know joy, not just because everything's falling apart, but because it's the real thing that doesn't change. I mean, what's interesting about joy is that it's like stumbling through the dark and bumping into something that is solid and real and lasting.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Digital Examine podcast. I'm Jay, and as always, I am so immensely grateful that you are joining us for today's conversation. You know, as we're recording this, just last night at our dinner table, I was sitting with Jenny, my wife, and our two young children. Our daughter is 10 and our son Simon is 7. And we're just beginning the early stages of real robust conversations about life and faith in Jesus and God, our Father who loves us, and the Spirit who dwells within those of us who follow Him. My kids are young, so they're still sort of figuring all of this stuff out, especially my son. He's, for a 7-year-old, one, he's a deeply thoughtful kid. And two, there's a natural sort of skepticism in him. And I don't know if it's just his age and it doesn't make sense, this whole God talk, or if there is a natural sort of sense of doubt in him. But something really strange and wonderful and beautiful happened yesterday. I'm going to do my best to not get emotional sharing this. Yesterday at dinner, we're sitting there, and unprompted, my son looks at me in between bites, and he says, "Dad, I got to tell you something. Today, I heard God talk to me for the very first time." I was stopped in my tracks. So, of course, naturally, I ask him, "Wow, buddy, that's amazing. Tell me more. What did he say?" And then my son, my 7-year-old, says, "I was in math class, and I'm not good at math. Math is hard for me. And then I heard God say, it's going to be okay. You're going to do just fine." And I had all sorts of thoughts and feelings. And I think, you know, maybe like my son, there's a natural skeptic in me. And part of me was like, did God really say that? What a strange thing for God to say. Does God really talk to 7-year-old kids as they're in the middle of math class, wondering if they're going to be able to figure out long division or something? And very quickly, it dawned on me, these are exactly the moments that God speaks, maybe with unique clarity. I'm still buzzing from that conversation now as I record this, because I think God really did talk to my son, because God always wants to talk, not just in the extraordinary moments of immense challenge or the deep, dark valleys. He, of course, wants to speak to us then. And not just in those moments where his tangible presence is undeniable. In the worship gathering, where the music is just so epic and our souls find ourselves soaring, you know? But in the quiet moments, when we're sitting trying to do long division or fold laundry or change a kid's diaper or code so that our boss is pleased with us or start the new business or balance the checkbook or wash the dishes or take out the trash or have coffee with a friend or a meal with our family. God wants to meet us in the extraordinary moments, but just as much so, he wants to meet us in the ordinary. And in every moment that God meets us, joy and delight, it's possible. Today, I am talking with my friend Tish Harrison Warren. Many of you know her work. Tish is an Anglican priest. She's an award-winning author, an incredibly gifted writer. Her books include Liturgy of the Ordinary and Prayer in the Night. She's been a regular contributor to the New York Times and Christianity Today. She's a senior fellow with the Trinity Forum. And she is one of the most thoughtful, and I would say one of the most important Christian voices we have today. And so I am so grateful for this chance that I had to have this conversation with Tish, and grateful that you all get to share in it with us. So without further ado, here is my conversation with my friend, Tish Harrison Warren. Tish, thank you so much for joining us on the Digital Examine podcast.
I'm so glad to be here. You know this, but your listeners might not, that I'm a fan of your work. So I'm grateful to be with you.
Well, the feeling is absolutely mutual, and I know lots of our listeners are fans of your work and have been formed in some really pivotal ways because of your work. I wanted to jump in and ask you just right away, you know, one of the things we try to do in the conversations we have here are sort of excavate, you know, into the depths. And it's one of the things that your work has for years now helped me do, is to pay attention. And that's kind of thematic in much of your writing. In Prayer in the Night, you have this line, you say, Christian discipleship is a lifetime of training in how to pay attention to the right things and to notice God's work in our lives and in the world and to unfix our gaze from distractions. So again, attention is this theme that you return to a lot in a lot of your work. It's been so helpful for me along those lines. Maybe like an opening question, that's kind of macro level. You know, when you consider the sort of frenetic pace of life in the modern age, what do you think we're losing in our failure to pay really careful attention to God's work and his presence in our life and in the world around us?
Well, that is a really great question. I do think attention is, of course, so much of what shapes our life and who we are, what we attend to, what we notice, what we meditate on. And I mean, it really cannot be overstated what a war is happening, like the warring that is occurring for our attention. So, I mean, this has always been the case. I was listening to a podcast this last week on, and it was dealing a lot with the Industrial Revolution, and it was talking about Belfast in 1912, I think it was. And someone was writing about how loud listening to the shipyards was, that it was this cacophony of noise that they had never heard before being in rural Ireland in the 19th century and early 20th century. And they said it made them feel physically sick, and there was some spiritual dimension to it. It felt like it, I can't remember the language, but it gave them a headache and made them sort of not be able to pay attention to anything else. So I don't want to pin this all on digitization. I think really for millions of years, or I'm not trying to make a evolution statement here, but however long humanity has existed in your imagination, there's been, human beings were made to be in silence, to have quiet, right? Without yeah. industrial noise, without industrial lights, the quiet of nighttime. We had these spaces built into our lives that we began losing with industrialization. But I do think digitization, of course, has thrown a lot of lighter fluid on that flame. And people are, corporations are making money off our attention from really the earliest age. And instead of what drives the economy now being, you know, widgets that someone's making in a factory, it's who can capture people's gaze. The thing that everyone is after is attention, which we know, but it means we are the target. And our spiritual lives and emotional lives are the target, because it is our emotional and spiritual lives that determine the things that catch our notice, right? So how this has affected us, it's really hard to even, and not sound hyperbolic, but it, I think it has changed our understanding of humanity and what it means to be human. This book is quoted a lot because it was pivotal and won a National Book Award and things. I actually don't know. It was nominated for a Pulitzer. I don't know if it won a National Book Award. But Nicholas Carr's The Shallows, that came out kind of right as the internet was becoming part of all of our lives and ubiquitous. And he talked about how, you know, the tools we use, the devices we use, really rewire our brains so that we are not able to pay attention anymore. We are not physically capable of it. We take in lots of small snatches of information, but to sit with an argument or a moment or a feeling inside of ourselves for any length of time, that we're really losing the capacity to do that. The implications for that, if you are someone that believes that contemplation is a really important part of the spiritual life, and not just, I mean, I don't mean that in a pietistic way, I mean of being fully alive, but also things like theological argument, intellectual argument, the ability to sit with a book and long form things, the ability to sit with another person in conversation and pay attention to them. If we lose those things, the ability to contemplate, the ability to sit with long, complex arguments, the ability to look someone in the eyes and be with them, we're losing everything. I mean, we're losing the core connection of human beings, the core ability to think, the core ability to connect with God and others. So I don't want to be alarmist, but I am alarmed, and I might be a little alarmist.
No, I think that's right. I would totally agree. I actually don't think it's alarmist at this point. I think even just if you just base it on data, it feels like it's pretty clear that we are, in essence, losing a significant part of what it means to be human. You mentioned Nicholas Carr and that book, The Shallows, which was incredibly impactful for me as well. He talks about, you know, in the digital age especially, we have lost the ability to dive into the depths of life, essentially. And now we just find ourselves jet skiing over the surface.
Yeah.
And
he says, I once was a scuba diver in a sea of words, and now I'm just a guy on a jet ski. Yeah. It's such
right.
a great line.
And yeah.
It's such a good line.
Yeah. And a lot of the stuff you've written, going way back even to like the Liturgy of the Ordinary, for me, help me focus, not just as a human, but like as a Christian, as a person who believes in the divine loving presence of God all around me. It helped me sort of reacclimate to that desire to dive into the depths. In that book, which I know you wrote a long time ago, so maybe you don't remember writing this, but you say, God, in delight and wisdom, has made, named, and blessed this average day. And what in my weakness see as another monotonous day in a string of days, God has given as a singular gift. I remember being like really arrested when I read that, because it struck me, man, I have such a sort of resistance to anything that feels on the surface like it's average. And that whole book, Liturgy of the Ordinary, is an invitation to see what on the surface looks average and normal and ordinary as a real gift. So, you know, continuing along this track of questions about just kind of assessing the modern conundrum we find ourselves in, like even for you, you know, why do you think it is so difficult for us as modern hurried people to believe that God really wants to meet us in the average ordinary day? And then, I don't know, have there been some like practices, you know, in your life that have been helpful to you on a personal level in doing that, in meeting God in the ordinary?
Well, you are right. I wrote Liturgy of the Ordinary came out in 2016. So I was writing it in 2014 and 15. I have this, I don't know, funny practice of I never read my books once they're out, partly because I will only see what's wrong with them. And so when people ask me about it now, which I'm happy to talk about, people ask all the time because it's still my most popular or, you know, best-selling book. And it changed my life. I'm very grateful for it. So no shade to Liturgy of the Ordinary. But I don't remember a lot of it because it's been 10 years and more than 10 years now. But it's funny because I'll read things and I'll be like, oh, man, that I still really struggle with that. I feel like, man, I should read this book. It feels like it'd be really helpful. whoever wrote this knows a lot more than I do. So why do I struggle? I think it's similar. You said you have a personality that sort of struggles with the average. I think I do too. I really, really often, most often write, particularly books, out of things that are hard for me, not out of things that I feel like I've mastered. It's the thing that feels like the cutting edge of growth in my life is, and the way that the only way I know to wrestle with God in that is to write, 60,000 words on it and edit it over 2 years. And then I kind of have some ideas about what I think. So Liturgy of the Ordinary is definitely that. It was born absolutely out of my struggle with ordinariness and with the reality that and part of what I contend in the book, it's inescapable. I think if tomorrow you woke up and you were president of the United States and you could, I don't know, or whatever, you had some superhuman strength, you could fly, you know, that would be exciting for about 3 months. And then you'd be like, ah, it's just an average Wednesday. You'd still wake up and you'd have to brush your teeth and you'd have to do your kids would be like not impressed anymore that you can fly and or that you're president. And so why do we struggle with this? I think there's multiple reasons, and I think it sort of depends on the personality, but I would say in general, I think we struggle with incarnational theology is the way to talk about this theologically. But the notion that God isn't out there somewhere far away, but that God would deign to be in the most mundane, quotidian moments of our life, I think is a hard idea. I think there's something in the human spirit that kind of puts God in a category far away from our daily life. Because of that, we feel the distance of God. And sometimes that distance is really painful. And sometimes maybe we do it we don't want God to be, and we don't want to have to deal with the notion that God is part of how we speak to our children or our spouse or roommate, or that God is, you know, somehow intimately involved in our emails, and, you know, and how we act online. And the idea that God is sort of distant, in some ways, it seems to preserve something like the sacredness of God. And of course, God is other and incomprehensible, uncontainable. But in the incarnation, I mean, the whole gospel is that the uncontainable dwindled to infancy, as Gerard Manley Hopkins says. So the whole idea of the incarnation is that there really is no moment, none. I mean, I'm talking about going to the bathroom, waking up, going to sleep, that God is not actively present and working in our lives. And there's something about us that resists that idea. It feels not special enough or not holy enough, or it feels intimidating somehow. At the same time, I think there's something just natural about that struggle. And yet, I also think there's something about discipleship, particularly with evangelicals, that, you know, I grew up kind of around the evangelical world. I think evangelicalism has been shaped by the notion of God meeting us in high emotion. And revivalism has hugely, hugely shaped American evangelicalism. And I'd make the argument American religion, period. And the idea of revivalism is there is a notion of kind of working people up to a, you know, there was the anxious bench in evangelical revivals where they wanted people to kind of get to this place of anxiety and then be, you know, be rescued by conversion. And then conversion is kind of the climax. And that's the big thing. But that really leaves out like a Wednesday afternoon and how God meets us in that. I also think as evangelicals, we can think of the gospel so much in terms of ideas, doctrine, which I think doctrine is super important, but it becomes really difficult to know what that has to do with what I do in my work life or, you know, the average day when I'm sitting in traffic. And so even I think the evangelical piety I was raised in was like the idea of quiet times, which I am not against quiet times. I mean, I think it's important to be quiet, and that's great. It's important to pray. It's important to have actual space in your life for that. But I think that it almost kind of reserves the practice of spirituality for these little moments of our choice, as opposed to this stream of the Spirit's work that we are in at every moment. And that flows through every bit of our day and life and bodies and time. And so, yeah, I think it is a human thing to struggle with God becoming so intimate in our lives that God is part of every moment. But I also think there is something particular about American evangelicalism that struggles with that because of our view of God, our view of what worship is, a lack of understanding of formation that's been in the last maybe decade since the book came out. There's been a ton of work and pushback on, I mean, there's just been a revival of interest in practices that I think is generally, not all, but generally good. Yeah. So I think it's a combination of how we are as humans and a combination of how we are as evangelicals and maybe even Americans. I do think as Americans, we have a sort of insatiable appetite for the interesting that does not serve us well as a culture.
Can I ask you, there's a lot that's been written in recent months, maybe the last couple of years, based on sort of church attendance trends, and where I live in the heart of Silicon Valley, in the last 3 months, there's been a lot of articles written broadly, you know, in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Atlantic. I mean, these like massive sort of secular news institutions that are writing about, hyperbolically, I might add, about this rise of Christianity in Silicon Valley amongst the tech elite and all those sorts of things. And it just strikes me, you know, not just like as someone on a podcast asking questions, but like as a pastor, you know, trying to serve a local congregation. Based on everything you just said, when you look at the landscape of the discourse publicly about this sort of, oh man, is Christianity making a comeback? Is this a revival? Are we in a season of renewal? I don't know. There's real beauty in that. Yes, I want lots and lots of people to encounter the risen Christ. I don't know. Does it give you any pause, or does it even strike any concern in you? Even the way we're talking about it, the pace at which we seem to be sort of rushing after revivalism or renewal, you know, in the secular West. I don't know. Would love to hear some of your thoughts on that, if there are any.
Yeah, I think, well, I do want to make a distinction between revival and revivalism, too. I think, I mean, big fan of revival.
Yeah.
And we should pray for that. We should seek that.
Yeah.
The difference I'm making there is revivalism, I think, is the notion that we can generate a revival through our work, through an emotional experience, through having good enough worship, good enough preaching, getting people all excited. And then also that makes then the sort of climax of the Christian life, the thing that all the pastors are seeking in that situation, or the preachers or the revivalist, is conversion, numbers. And then we lack depth. And I mean, Eugene Peterson wrote in Long Obedience in the Same Direction. This is like in the 80s. So this is, you know, way before our moment now. But he talked about how he said something like, anything in our culture of consumerism can be packaged and marketed and sold if it seems new. Even, he said, religious, even a relationship with God. But then it ends up, he said, on the garbage heap, you know, when it's not new anymore. And so how do you do the work of a long sustained discipleship over time is a question of mine that doesn't, revivalism doesn't really have an answer for. And that's kind of my problem with revivalism. But that is different than revival, because revival is an encounter with the living God that sometimes seems to, in God's grace and mercy, sweep over a culture in a moment. What proves what a true revival is versus a false revival is if over time the church is renewed, discipleship grows, there is repentance, there's repentance for injustice and repentance for, and like personal holiness grows, you know. So I think, even, I don't, this isn't what you were talking about with the Asbury revival. There was a lot of talk, is this revival, is it not? And my answer was sort of like, all of us should kind of not touch it. Like, don't, like, let, like, in the sense of sort of like, we don't really know what's being planted here. We'll probably know in 5 to 10 years. Like, I think that it will take like time to see what fruit is born. So are we in a revival? I don't know. I think there is a renewed interest in young people, it seems, in faith. And particularly, I would say, in types of faith that ask something of you. And I think that's getting a lot of attention because people are surprised. There was always a trend for so long of kind of the young getting less religious. And I think there was an assumption by kind of Gen Xers of, you know, who felt, Gen Xers who deconstructed or left the faith, or, you know, felt like, you know, especially the more rigorous or orthodox or evangelical versions of faith were something they felt they were escaping from, that if young people were raised in a place, if we could sort of all just live in a place where religion wasn't, you know, foisted on us, that we'd all kind of leave it behind. And so these folks who are younger and have really no social, I mean, I understand maybe in MAGA circles or Republican circles, there can be still social pressure to kind of confess faith, at least with words. But I live in Austin, Texas. Like, there's no social benefit for being a Christian in Austin. Like, if anything, I would say there's like a deep social skepticism towards it. So there was a notion that when Christendom is dead, why would young people, we'll all be free of it? And so the notion that the young people, I have a little church plant. And just this year, we kind of got this wave of 20-somethings, which is not, the church is 2 years old. It's its second year. And we haven't really had that demographic. And there, I mean, it's not overwhelming. It's probably like 10 people, but it's a little church. So that's not, That's, we have about 100. So, and, but these folks have no social reason to come to our church, but they are amazing and they're super interested. They really want to learn. They really want to talk about theology. They really want to be challenged. They want to learn to pray. And it's not because they've had a big emotional experience at a, you know, and gotten fired up. It's not because there's any social benefit to this. It's not even necessarily because they were raised this way. Some of them were, but, and so I am intrigued by that. And particularly, like, I mean, our church doesn't have, we never post sermons on Instagram. We have essentially no, we did not have a website for the first year that we were existed. It was a joke that it was like a speakeasy church. Like you couldn't find out. You had to hear. You had to do the secret knock to even get in. So, so the fact that these folks, I mean, I'm just intrigued. I think I'm intrigued. And that it's like our service is quiet and it's just a really, I don't want to say it's an average church because it's like lovely and beautiful and the Lord is at work, but it's not, we're not like hip and targeting the young people and it, but they're just coming. And so, I think, I don't know. I think I am intrigued by what's happening.
Yeah.
Is this something that's going to last and be culturally transformative? I just think it's way too early to know. Mm-hmm. And is this a way that, is it, I mean, in the way that this ricochets and gets tangled up in politics is a whole other question, but yeah.
Yeah. That's really beautiful. I think that, you know, the invitation sort of to slow down. I think we're all so quick to try to figure things out and we miss so much, you know, in just figuring it out. We miss so much in the experience of it. It's a really helpful thought for me, even just as a pastor and as a Christian. I wanna ask specifically, just getting a bit more personal into the lives of the people who are listening and watching. I want to ask about joy. It's a sort of a theme we've been exploring throughout this season of the podcast. And I mean, it's been said sort almost sort of ad nauseum now, but you know, many people assume joy is a feeling, but that's been said so much that most people now assume like, no, I know joy is not a feeling.
But
but it's also, I mean, the pendulum can swing so far. It's like, well, it does feel like something, you know, it's not like just some abstract idea floating in the ether. But I love in Prayer in the Night, you have this line, you say that joy is, it's a gift and a practice. I love that it's both, not primarily a feeling, it's a gift and a practice. But this is what really struck me. You say it is a muscle we can strengthen with exercise. So I want to ask you about that, maybe specifically for people who have not read the book. First of all, go read the book. But secondly, what do you mean by that? How is joy a muscle we can strengthen? And then what does exercising joy look like in sort of our everyday lives? Or what could it look like?
Well, it's funny. I saw that I knew you were going to ask a lot of questions on joy, and I was intimidated by it because I do think I am a person that struggles a lot with joy. Like, I don't think when people get to know me well, I think they would, I like tend towards melancholy, or I don't even know if that's true, but I'm not, there's kind of like naturally positive, joyful people, and I am not one of them. So because of that, I think going back to the thing I said about, you know, I wrote about Liturgy of the Ordinary because I struggle with the ordinary. I think I end up writing about joy a lot because I'm like, what is this thing? And how does one know it and seek it? And I picked up exactly on what you just said, Jay, but that we hear so much that joy is not a feeling, that it is as if that is all to be said about it. And also, when I write Prayer in the Night, it's all framed, the whole book is framed about around one particular prayer in Compline, which is nighttime prayer. And there's this phrase, shield the joyous. So I knew I was going to have to write on joy. And it's funny because the book is intense and hard. It's a lot about suffering. It's a lot about theodicy. But the hardest chapter for me to write was about joy. And so I started asking pastors, like, tell me what you think about joy. What is joy? How does one pursue joy? Like, I have a lot of friends in ministry. I'm an Anglican priest. I was talking to a bunch of people. And I just very quickly realized, like, oh my gosh, pastors are terrible at talking about joy. They're terrible because they do focus so much on it's not a feeling that doesn't tell me what it is. But it's also like, man, like, you know, it's so much that it's kind of like the way they talk about joy is like it's there when everything goes wrong, when you've lost all your family and all your friends and you've lost your home and your legs. And then, you know, joy. And it's almost like, man, I hope I never find out what joy is because it sounds terrible. And so I wrote that whole chapter struggling with like, no, there's got to be something about that is can be named as joy that has to do with sitting with friends around a fire pit and having good conversation and, you know, children running around and laughing and eating ice cream. Like, there's got to be something in the human experience that gestures to happiness and enjoyment that might have something to do with joy. And yet, we don't want to say, you know, joy is just that. Joy is just eating ice cream or being with friends around a fire pit or getting a manicure. I mean, whatever. I don't know. I don't even enjoy manicures. But they're saying, like, whatever is your thing, kayaking, I don't know. Because then it does become this consumer product, right? Then joy is about getting the best stuff and having even the most friends or, like, you know, whatever. So it is a tension, and it is the tension I try to deal with in that chapter. And so what I sort of come to is the idea of sacramentality, which is a real something Anglicans talk about a lot, but it's the idea that when we sort of the way that we encounter something transcendent, eternal, spiritual is through fleshly things. So the ultimate example would be like the sacraments themselves, where we encounter mystically the presence of Christ through bread and wine, these like really common things you can find in your kitchen. But that in our church service and the place of the Eucharist or communion become this sort of, I don't even know if this is the right word, but something like a portal to something lasting and eternal, something that's happening in real time in heaven, in the place of God, the place where God dwells. So the idea that it is like through these little earthy things that we is actually the only door into the infinite that became something that is what the chapter sort of lands on. It feels like it holds together. So we can truly, truly say when you have a really good meal with friends and you're eating dessert and you're all laughing together, that is a human experience of joy. That experience touches on something lasting and eternal that still exists, even when everyone around that table is dead and gone. That we can truly affirm the beauty and the good moments of something that looks like, I don't want to say joy in the definition, but delight, because they are connected to an eternal reality of God and God's joy. So that's not like, and now I've got it figured out, but I think that we are wrestling as a culture and also as a, I want to say specifically as a Christian culture about how do we speak about joy in a better, how do we talk about it better? And it's something I want to write more on. I have a book coming out in May and there's an entire kind of section about delight and joy. Because I am wrestling with these kinds of ideas that you're saying.
Yeah.
How do we talk about it as a feeling, but not just a feeling, but not make joy sound like something horrible that we hope doesn't happen to us. So,
yeah.
Or, you know, there's something, joy is profoundly spiritual. It is a fruit of the spirit. But there's something, when we try to evacuate it of all subjective human experience of joy in the world, it becomes strangely kind of Gnostic and over spiritualized in a way that it almost seems like joy doesn't touch the earth. And it has to. It has to flow from heaven, but it has to touch the earth if it's going to be something that we can actually experience.
I want to pause from our conversation with Tish here and give you a moment to reflect. Wherever you are, begin taking some deep breaths. If it's safe for you to do so, you might consider closing your eyes. If you're able to sit someplace, maybe you sit and just feel your feet planted firmly on the ground, reminding you that you stand on solid ground. And even if life, the world, feels destabilized, like it's shaking, you stand on the foundation of Christ and all will be well. I want you to take a moment and ponder some of what Tish has just offered to us. I want us to think about joy, about what it is, what it isn't. Maybe ponder moments, recent moments of joy that felt like s'mores over a fire or a wonderful meal with friends. And then from there, ponder recent moments of joy that were actually found and excavated from the depths of pain and struggle. And from there, maybe ponder recent moments of joy that you maybe didn't even realize was joy, in the long, mundane, ordinary moments of your life. And just spend a moment thanking God for all of that joy, and the highs and the lows and the in-betweens, and ask Him by His Spirit to give you eyes to see and ears to hear joy more clearly in your life in those moments when it feels hidden. So take a moment, ponder, pray, and then we'll come back to our conversation with Tish.
How can we trust God in the dark? From the author of Liturgy of the Ordinary, Tish Harrison Warren offers an honest, prayerful approach to the difficulty of ordinary life in her book, Prayer in the Night. Accompanied by discussion questions and spiritual practices, Warren explores themes of human vulnerability, suffering, and God's seeming absence, framed around a grounding nighttime prayer of Compline. And as a listener of this podcast, you can receive a special discount on this book. Check the show notes for more details.
The line you just said, I think, is so profound. It flows from heaven, but it has to touch the earth, which feels thematic to the conversation we're having. It's obviously a sacramental sort of posture toward the world. And I do wonder, as I'm listening to you talk, if that is really the only fathomable way to think about joy and experience it fully in its sort of fullness of, you know, just how expansive it is, and that we've taken sort of slices. And you're right, pastors, myself included, have spent way too much time telling people what joy isn't, and then telling people how awful it really is. and then we just call it this three-letter word kind of thing. And it's not to say it's not that. It's just that's a sort of single slice. But you mentioned, you know, this new book you have coming out, which I'm so excited for. And the chapter you have in it on joy, the book is called What Grows in Weary Lands on Christian Resilience, which when I saw the subtitle alone, I just thought, yeah, man, I'm so glad, because resilience, one, just feels like it's in short supply in my own life. Not because I don't think I'm a resilient person, but because I feel weary. And I feel like my tank of resilience gets burnt up all the time. You know, much of it because of my own sort of lack of discipline, whether it's scrolling my phone or whatever it might be. So, I mean, first of all, just high level, tell us about the book and tell us, you know, in the last couple of years, like what moved you in this direction? What compelled you to write about resilience?
The book comes out in May, and you are the second human that I've talked to outside of like my editor and the people at Penguin Random House and Convergent. So I might be out of practice, guys. But the book is about essentially how does one sustain faith over time? And particularly, it's really aimed at times of, I mean, I believe all of us encounter times of exhaustion, of weariness, of burnout, and of times, as I say in the book, that we are not depressed, but it's this weird twilight that we live, I would say, the majority of our lives in, where we are not in depression, we are not in despair, we are not even necessarily in deepest suffering, but we are also not having a sense of flourishing or joy. It's in that sort of middle space where we are weary and where we are struggling with, you know, how to keep going and how to not grow weary in well-doing or doing good, as Galatians says. So I encountered the book talks about that, and then it really, really pulls. What I found is the space, this twilight space between flourishing and depression that I isn't addressed much in the church, particularly evangelicalism, maybe. When you start digging into the Christian tradition, it's just talked about all the time. Like, there are so many resources in the history of the faith for this experience. It's talked about in different ways, but essentially every branch of Christian tradition is like wrestling with this very common human experience of weariness and lack of resilience or struggling. What exactly what you said of the your tank kind of being used up, and how does one refill in that? And so I'm pulling from loads of Christian voices throughout history, but I particularly focus on the earliest Christian monks from the 3rd to the 5th century, these desert fathers and mothers. Mm-hmm. So the book is framed around sayings and stories of the desert fathers and mothers, but them interacting with my own experience and with the experience of our culture around burnout and then also the experience of Christians throughout history. And so it's a book about the desert of our lives, the internal desert we face, I think, as a Western culture now. But that came because I have been in a pretty profound season of burnout in my own life and weariness and exhaustion. Pretty much everything you just said, I deeply identify with. And I worked for the New York Times for 2 years, which was wonderful, great experience. Could talk about that, could process that for the next hour. But it was so amazing in ways, but also really hard and really, really intense. Really one of the most difficult things I've ever done. And so I chose to leave the Times and really entered a period of kind of a dark night of the soul, trying to figure out how does one continue in faith? How does one sustain faith? How do you deal with doubt? How do you deal with weariness? And then I found all these old monks from the 3rd and 4th century that were writing about this in ways that felt like it was my journal, that felt like it was super relatable. And so it's kind of my story of finding these guys and women. There were lots of desert mothers, something more than there were desert fathers even, that really were just, it's just like remarkably psychologically relevant to the conversations we're having right now. And so I'm bringing all of that together in the book.
Well, I can't wait. You know, even just you describing the new book reminds me of one of the reasons, long before I ever had a chance to connect with you, many years before we ever had a chance to connect, just your work. One of the things that was so resonant with me, and I know resonant with so many people who are familiar with your work, is how honest you are in all of the sort of brutality and beauty of like our honest, you know, bearing it all sort of lives. And even this brief description you gave of the book coming up offers a glimpse of that. So I'm just so grateful, Tish, for who you are and for the way God, by his spirit, is speaking through you into so many lives. As we conclude the conversation, just sort of along those lines, my guess is the majority, probably the overwhelming majority of people listening and watching feel that they feel exhausted. And whatever you want to call it, maybe some are like truly depressed and others are just like, no, I'm just really tired.
Yeah.
I'm certainly weary. I'm burnt out. My tank is on empty, whatever it might be. So as we conclude, you know, from your place of brutal, beautiful honesty, would you just give our folks a word of blessing for their exhausted, burnt out lives, that God is still in their midst?
I will. I want to say something first about that. And this kind of pulls together, I think, some of, honestly, our whole conversation, what we were talking about revival, what we were saying about joy. I heard Paul Kingsnorth in an interview with Ross Douthat this past week or two. And he talked about how Christianity becomes most interesting and intelligible as things are falling apart. When civilization seems to be shifting. I mean, we have to remember, like, our earliest Christian brothers and sisters were in a place of oppression, then the fall of Rome. I mean, things were profoundly in flux, and things were profoundly unpredictable. And this is the place that the church, this was the soil where the church was planted and grew. And so I think out of that spirit, I want to say we are in a time, each one of us, whether you feel like life individually is going great for you or life's going really hard, I think all of us feel that we're in a time of rapid change, of profound polarization, of shifting global power, of financial uncertainty. And all of these can seem abstract, but we've all tasted them in a thousand ways in our regular life. People that we knew really well who seem radically different people than they were 4 or 5 years ago. Friendships won and friendships lost, and a profound disillusionment and maybe disorientation of not knowing who we are or where we are in the world and what the gospel means for our moment in history. When things like AI are on the horizon and things that we're facing things as parents and as humans that we just haven't before. So in the midst of this, I want to remind us that this is when the gospel is most intelligible. The gospel is for the moments when things seem to be falling apart. And this is when we can know joy, not just because everything's falling apart, but because it's the real thing that doesn't change. I mean, what's interesting about joy is that it's like stumbling through the dark and bumping into something that is solid and real and lasting. So my blessing for folks is that in the ways, the moments where it feels like things are falling apart, I mean this on a political, national, global scale, but also on their Wednesday when it feels like they're relationships with people around them is difficult, when their schedule of what they thought they would do that day is falling apart, when their, you know, literal like clothes dryer is breaking and falling apart, and the whatever falling apart looks like for you, that the Lord in heaven is still a God who experiences joy right now, that God delights over his creation, delights over his people, delights over his church with all of its brokenness, and delights over you. And that God, as the nations rage, as we hear in the Psalms, the Lord in heaven laughs. That there's this response that nothing is out of his control. As crazy and intense as things get here, we are a bit like toddlers fighting. And there's this one who loves us still and is coming after us. So may the God of all peace fill you with great, great joy.
What a gift. Tish, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Thank you for your work. And yeah, just greatly, greatly appreciate you.
Yeah, it was so good to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us for another conversation on the Digital Examine. As always, if this podcast is a blessing or a gift to you in any way, it's a tremendous help to us if you would like it, review it wherever you get your podcasts, share it with friends if you think it would be a blessing to them. And as always, I want to leave you with our final prayer of blessing as you go. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in this still moment, we pause to rest and relax into your presence. We thank you for the gift of this day, for the moments of light and levity and all of your many graces, big and small. Help us to notice the goodness you weave in and through all things. Help us to reflect honestly on our missteps, to bring them to you humbly. We trust in your mercy, which is always healing, always restoring. Remind us of your nearness in our joy, our sorrow, and all our in-betweens. As we look to tomorrow, grant us the courage to surrender our plans to your care and fill us with the trust that is grounded in your goodness, and open our hearts wide to your love that we may carry your grace into the world. Amen. The Digital Examine is a production of InterVarsity Press. For more information on any IVP titles mentioned on this episode, visit ivpress.com and use the promo code in the show notes for a special discount. Sound engineering by Honest Podcasts. Our producers are Christine Policio Mello and Travis Albritton. And I'm your host, J.Y. Kim. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the IVP YouTube channel, and leave a rating and review to support the show.